I started trying to put two today, so much for you and probably for me. Probably I have to be more conservative. And today I'll just do hopefully just 1 hour, 1 hour and 15, 1 hour and 15, and conclude Monday, okay? So far in the course, we've been developing a lot of tools and technology to study arbitrary CFTs. And you know, it's a little bit like going into a hike, that before you see all the beautiful views, you have to suffer a little bit, have to sweat and so on. And now we're getting to the point where that we developed all these tools that you can start seeing many, many applications. And I wouldn't forgive myself if I didn't finish the course with some explicit applications of CFTs, even though I mentioned several of them during the course. At least I want to explicitly show you how to use all these tools we developed to extract physical properties of interesting statistical models, like the Ising model. Probably the complete solution of the Ising model, meaning the spectrum and correlation functions, I will only complete next on Monday. But today I want to give the last, so introduce infinite class of models in two dimensions, okay, that for which we in principle know how to compute everything, and then we will see how we're going to do that, and for which we have a one-to-one correspondence between these conformal field theories. And we know that these conformal field theories describe the critical behavior of an infinite class of lattice models that you can write down, the simplest one of them being the Ising model. Okay? And we will see that by doing something which will be fairly elementary in some general terms, we'll be able to extract results that would be incredibly hard to obtain if you started from the lattice Hamiltonian, okay? And that's kind of the power of the CFT, that you forget about the very complicated microscopic Hamiltonian. You identify what the relevant degrees of freedom in the infrared are, and you just solve the theory in the infrared, and you get all the physics out. Now, for many of these models, with a lot of hard work, people also solve the lattice Hamiltonian exactly, and then you can compare the results that you get from the lattice, the exact solution of the lattice model and from the CFT point of view, and you, of course, get agreement. But the point is that this, well, first of all, is technically simpler, but also sheds light on the physics that, as we described several times already, at very large distances, the details of the microscopic Hamiltonian are not very important as you approach a second-order phase transition, and all that really matters is what is the scaling behavior as you approach the critical point. And that's really captured just by a CFT. Okay, so now I want to introduce you to a special class of models that we can completely solve. These are called the minimal models. In two dimensions, okay? And we will see how they arise. First of all, there is an infinite family of them, okay? We will see that they're labeled by two relatively prime integers. And as I've already been saying now and in previous lectures, these conformal field theories describe some interesting critical phenomena in two dimensions of continuous phase transitions in two dimensions. And remember that we already had this very simple intuitive argument that in two dimensions there should be many different critical behaviors. Because in two dimensions, any operator that you construct out of a scalar is relevant, okay? So you can start from the free theory and generate flows to hopefully many other non-trivial fixed points. So you can have this picture of the flows that we had, where we started, say, from the free theory, just a scalar field theory. And then by deforming by various operators, by deforming the Lagrangian of the theory by some operator, you could flow to some non-trivial fixed point. So by this, I mean fixed points of the normalization group, okay, and so on. And since you have an infinite number of directions, you can hope to get many different CFDs, okay? And precisely this picture, this nice picture of flows, is exactly what these minimal models realize, okay? Good. So now let me tell you a little bit more in detail what these minimal models are and what their basic properties are. And then we will later, in this lecture, we will see, I'll sketch for you how they arise from given the story that I've told you before about representations of the Virasoro algebra and how to construct the states associated to a primary by acting with the Virasoro descendants. And we will see that this, the minimal models have very special properties when it comes to the study of the representations associated to the primaries. Okay? So the first thing to say is that these minimal models are labeled by two integers, by two relatively prime integers. PQ. Okay, and so usually we will call them MPQ. One important property that they have is that their central charge is necessarily smaller than one. So the central charge is one of the basic identifiable properties of a CFD. And minimal models always live in a window which is C less than one, okay? And has this particular form of the central charge. Something like that, okay? So that's one property that they have. We already know from the discussion from the last lecture is that not all minimal models that are labeled by these integers P and Q will be unitary, okay? Remember that we systematically studied the matrix of inner products in the Hilbert space of a conformal field theory. And we saw how, by studying unitarity at different levels, different regions, in particular, in the C less than one region, were carved out just on the requirement that you only have positive definite norms in the Hilbert space. For example, this is something that we obtain at level 2. And the endpoint of this analysis, which is the hard analysis that I didn't really go through, and even different Francesco doesn't really do very systematically, of what is the end result of the analysis of what regions remain after you impose unitarity at all levels, the claim was that there was a discrete set of unitary models that were labeled by one integer, okay? Which, of course, will be in this family. But this family is broader, so this contains unitary and non-unitary CFDs. The unitary ones are the ones that are M plus 1. Where M, remember, was an integer. Which I think in this normalization, it starts with 3, 4, 5, so on. Okay. Now, you would say, why would you study models that are not unitary? It turns out in condensed matter physics, there are many interesting applications to physical systems associated to conformal field theories that are not unitary. Like people in condensed matter study, in statistical physics, they study the partition function of the Ising model in the presence of an imaginary magnetic field, to study the singularities of that partition function. And that's described by one of these minimal models, but it's not in the unitary series. Or also, non-unitary CFTs are also appearing in the discussion of percolation in two dimensions. So for the time being, we'll keep all of them. And even though for the time that I have left, I'll mainly focus on the unitary ones. Okay. The crucial property that these CFTs have is that they have a finite number of primary operators. Okay. That makes them more tractable. Generically,
a CFT, if you write down a free field theory, a free field theory generically will have an infinite number of primary operators. Just take phi to any power. But these theories have a special property that they have a finite number of them, which will make them soluble. So they're going to be labeled by two integers, RS. R goes from 1 to Q minus 1. S equals 1 to Q minus 1. And subject to an identification. So there is an equivalence relation. So this labeling is redundant. We have identification. It's actually a reflection around the diagonal. So the operator phi q minus r p minus s is just the same as phi rs. Okay? So it's a redundant description if you want to label them by r and s from 1 to q and minus 1 and s from 1 to p minus 1. So in total, you have have 1 half p minus 1 q minus 1 primary operators. Of course, since this is a CFT, the CFT itself has an infinite number of operators because any primary has an infinite number of descendants. But the key point is that kind of the irreducible operators, the primaries, are just finite dimensional. And the thing that's remarkable about them, and we will see why, is that these operators close among themselves when you multiply them. So think of this RS as a label. So this RS obviously is a label of a representation of the Virasoro algebra, right? Its primary has associated a certain representation of the Virasoro algebra. And if you have intuition from, say, SU2, if you take two operators that transform in two different representations of SU2 and you multiply them, you get something else, right? And typically what happens, well, in the case of SU2, what happens is that you can keep doing that. So you can start with a spin and half representation and multiply it an arbitrary number of times. And you keep getting higher and higher spins, OK? The thing that's remarkable about this case is that if you take any of these operators and you start multiplying them together, they form a closed set, OK? A finite dimensional set. In some sense, the maximal spin that you can get is, there's a maximal spin that you can get, OK? So you can keep multiplying them. Like the analog of multiplying the spin one half representations, you can only do a finite number of times because eventually you get zero. Okay. And in that respect, they're very simple. I mean, they're just a very small set of representations that close among themselves when you tensor them. Okay. And we will see how this arises from the structure of the descendants associated to these primaries. And as I said, any of these models has associated with them. People have identified the critical behavior with the critical behavior of two-dimensional lattice models, okay? So let me describe a couple of them just. So one of them will be the main guy that we will discuss, even though the tools I will introduce today and on Monday should be sufficient for you to, in principle, be able to solve any of these CFTs. But I'll start with the Ising model because that's, in some sense, the simplest one. This CFT, if you plug in these values of P and Q, has central charge equals 1/2. Okay. It has the following spectrum of operators, primaries. So they're labeled by this pair of integers, and I choose the following representatives. So 1, 1, 2, 2, and 2, 1. Okay. So these are just abstract nonsense names that we don't have a physical intuition for what those mean. Now, the first thing to say is that this CFT describes the Ising model at the Curie transition. So remember that we discussed this a little bit. Okay, not a little bit, quite a bit in the first part. So we had this picture. So I guess let me remind you quickly what this Ising-Hamiltonian is. So it's a model that lives on a lattice. And each side on the lattice, there is a spin. So each side, say sigma I, can take values plus 1 or minus 1. Okay. And at least the usual Hamiltonian that people usually consider has only nearest neighbor interactions between spins. So that means that each spin here can only interact, has a term in the Hamiltonian that couples it with its nearest neighbor. Okay. Okay. So in formulas, this is just a statement that the Hamiltonian is the sum of some parameter k that just tells you what the energy, what the basic energy scale is. So you have sigma I, sigma j. So you have a term in the Hamiltonian that couples two spins that are nearest neighbor. This funny symbol just means nearest neighbor. Okay. So that's the standard Ising-Hamiltonian. Is there some other term that you could think of to write down in the Hamiltonian? Sorry? Yeah. Yeah, so you could add next to nearest neighbor. That's not what I was looking for, but it's a good answer. I mean.
I said external Q.
Oh, sorry. I'm deafer than usual because my ears are completely clogged. So you said external field, OK. So how would you write it?
Minus a plus H, sum of sigma.
OK, good. So this would be like a magnetic field. But if you had answered what I thought you answered, it was also a good answer. But let me not go through that. I think I discussed that earlier in the course, that there was a statement that even though you start with this Hamiltonian with only nearest neighbor interactions, if you study what happens at large and large distances, and you do the idea of real space renormalization, where you reduce this lattice into a coarser lattice, and you replace a spin by an effective spin that covers a range of the lattice, and you integrate out the smaller spins in its big block, that you automatically generate, even though you started with a Hamiltonian that only has nearest neighbor interactions, this procedure will generate all possible interactions, including non-nearest neighbor interactions. Okay? And that was kind of the real space renormalization point of view of this picture of effective field theory, where if you start with a set of degrees of freedom and you integrate out from high energies to low energies, you generate all possible interactions that you can possibly get. Don't worry about that. Not everything there was completely clear, but I hope at least part of it was. So now, essentially, we have three operators here. We will later compute their dimensions, but let me just, for the time being, tell you what the dimensions is. This is the identity operator, who has dimension 0. This guy has dimension 1/16, and this guy has dimension 1/2, OK? And just one way to do the mapping, which of course, this is just a consistency check. You have to do much harder analysis to really show that this describes the Ising model universality class, is that these operators in the Ising language so first of all, these three operators are obviously relevant, right? They all have dimension less than 1. Is that clear? So these are things that I could add to my Hamiltonian, if you wanted. And now you might ask, if this model is really describing the critical point of the Ising model. OK, so here, just to remind you very quickly, the phase diagram of the Ising model was the following. You had this axis k. There was a range. There was a line of first order phase transition. So. That extended between zero temperature to some critical temperature, which is the Curie temperature, across which the magnetization, which is a first derivative of the free energy jump, that was a first order phase transition. But at the end point of this line of first order phase transition, there was a second order phase transition. You see? So some critical point, which I think, well, one can show from the lattice model that this is the value of the critical temperature at which correlation length, in which the spins have fluctuations at all length scales. Okay. Now, this CFT is describing the physics at this point. Okay. But now you may wonder, what is the interpretation from the point of view of the Ising Hamiltonian of this operator? Okay. So this guy should be quite clear. So if I start with the Hamiltonian at the critical point, where k equals kc, from the, and now I have my CFT, and I perturb it by the identity operator, all that it really does, it doesn't do anything. It just shifts the energy of the Hamiltonian, of the lattice Hamiltonian, by an overall constant. Okay, that's not very interesting. So that doesn't do anything, essentially. It just shifts what you mean by the zero-point energy of the system. Now, this guy is much more interesting. This guy, actually, what kind of deformations can you do here once you're at the critical point? You can either change the value of the temperature, or of k, or you can turn on a magnetic field. Okay. So these two operators in the lattice correspond to turning on, so changing kc to kc plus delta kc plus delta k. So that means that if I have my CFT and I perturb it by an operator like this, phi to 1, this has interpretation as changing the Hamiltonian of the Ising model away from the critical point. And this guy has a similar interpretation, which is changing or turning on . So here, remember that this was a magnetic field. Turning on a magnetic field. So that would correspond to turning the operator phi.
Could you repeat what you mean by anything?
By?
Anything.
Anything. No, I just mean that, I mean, I could have added here any constant I wanted.
Oh, okay.
So just saying that if I deform my Hamiltonian by the identity operator, it just adds to the Hamiltonian just an overall energy. So it's not interesting. I don't know why you put anything there, but I'm sure you have something in mind. It just means that you shift the energy by, it doesn't really have a very deep physical interpretation. Well, these two guys, they do. They really change. They move you away from the critical point by moving you in this axis, which is the critical temperature, changing the temperature or the coupling, or turning on a magnetic field. Okay. And I should say that this kind of detailed dictionary between the spectrum of operators in the minimal models and the spectrum of operators in the associated microscopic lattice Hamiltonian worked out for any of these models. Yes?
Do all of them have h bar 0?
No. Yeah, so all this, all essentially, all the models I will discuss will have the property that they have h equals h bar. Yes?
Why don't we get any operators which would correspond to turning on interactions with more faraway neighbors?
Those would be irrelevant operators. And I know how to describe them. OK, so that's a good question. There's a way of describing them by noting, but maybe let's move on this until Monday. There is another formulation of it. So right now in CFT here, I'm using kind of abstract language, right? I just tell you have a set of operators that have a certain set of properties. But for this particular case, there is a description of the Ising CFT in terms of free fermion. Actually, I think you had a tutorial of that. I mean, if you remember the tutorial, you at some point you were, I think they had a tutorial on the free fermion. Oh, I thought it was.
Yeah, there was an exercise to find this C equal 1/2 and the OP
Yes, I thought you had a problem with compute the central charge of free Fermi into the
dimension. Oh, yes, we did. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, good. I mean, maybe the drugs are kicking in, I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah, so, okay, so that of course doesn't nail this in yet, but another point about this Ising CFT is that it can also be described in terms of this free fermion CFT. And there it's quite clear how you would construct the irrelevant operators. And essentially it would be by, can I postpone that when I discuss that the free fermion picture? Because that would take me too far. Good. Now, something that I said here before, Aklan, and let's use this language. So we will call this the identity, the sigma operator. This is like the spin. And this is usually called the energy operator. It's called the energy operator because it's the operator that changes the energy term in the Hamiltonian. Okay. So one of the things that I said here is that the OPE of these operators is closed.
A short question. When you see that h is equal to h bar,
yes,
it means that spin is zero.
Yes, it's scalar.
So why do you say that this is free fragments?
No, because you have, because the operators, when you write in terms of free fragments, will have h equals zero. So you'll have psi and psi bar. Okay. And when you write it in terms, for example, the energy operator will be psi bar psi, and it will have spin zero. Now, there are very interesting, the kind of models or CFTs for which H equals H bar, so that any operator is completely symmetric on the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic side, are called diagonal models for obvious reasons, because they have a symmetry between left and right. There are many models, and I'll mention very briefly one, in which this is not the case, where you can have operators that have different quantum numbers on the left and on the right. They still have to satisfy some consistency condition. Like, for example, h minus h bar has to be an integer. And those that do describe also interesting lattice models. But for the Ising model, it's a diagonal model, so h equals h bar. And in the fermion language, you have to have a left moving and a right moving holomorphic anti-holomorphic fermion. Good. So what I wanted to say here is that the how the OPE truncates just at the level of representation. So why these operators form a closed algebra? And the multiplication table in this case is just this. Now, there is an important symmetry in this representation table. Can someone see a symmetry here?
So a question, what's epsilon in this?
This is the name, just to, because they're awful, this one, two, and so on. This is the name associated to the energy operator, which is the one that changes the value of the Hamiltonian. Instead of calling it phi to 1, I'm just calling it epsilon. And sigma is the operator associated with changing, turning on a magnetic field.
So this identity there is the same as?
Yeah, so the identity is the identity.
Yeah.
I guess that's it. Yeah. Yeah, so clearly there is a symmetry. A Z2 symmetry that maps sigma to minus sigma, right? And leaves everyone else invariant. Okay. And this is also a symmetry that you expect from the Ising model. A zero magnetic field has exactly the symmetry that doesn't matter. I can flip all my spins from sigma to minus sigma. Okay. And this discrete symmetry is when these models were identified, when the lattice models were identified with this family of CFTs, played a crucial role in establishing the dictionary. Good, let me move on. I mean,
how do you get the OPEs?
Yeah, so that's something that, right now I'm just kind of introducing things and then I'll show you how to derive it. What we will use is things that we already know. Essentially, it will follow from the properties of the descendants of the primaries with this very specific value of the central chart and scaling on it. So this Isaac model has the property that in order to reach a zero magnetic field, in order to reach the critical point, you have to tune one parameter in the Hamiltonian, right? You have to tune the temperature, essentially. In general, you can have, so I don't want to spend too much time on this, but let me just mention that. You can have multi-critical point. Okay? So these are models that have a phase diagram that in order to reach the critical point, you have to tune more than one parameter, okay? Have you guys seen this word before in the statistical mechanics or somewhere? No?
We've seen tricritical.
Sorry?
We've seen tricritical.
So the next example I had in mind that I don't want to write a Hamiltonian for, but it would be the 5-4 model. This would describe the tricritical Isaac model. So this is a model that generalizes this interaction. So it has a more complicated Hamiltonian. It has more terms in the Hamiltonian. And that has a critical point that is it is tuned by turning on more than one parameter, by tuning more than one parameter. It's essentially the order of the multicriticality is the number of knobs that experimentalist has to tune to reach the critical behavior. Okay? And there are many models, interesting models that have multicritical behavior, in particular this one. And also these kind of interesting models are described by these CFTs. Okay? And the last one I want to just mention is that there are nice generalizations of the Ising model where the sigma takes values between plus and minus one to what are called the POTS models. Where the Hamiltonian is a function of some spin variables, but where now is again is a lattice model with only nearest neighbor interactions. But now at each lattice site, the spin can take sigma i can take q values. And the energy functional in this case is the Kronecker delta. So essentially, the term in the Hamiltonian vanishes unless the spin in the two neighboring sites takes the same value. Okay. And for this particular case of q equals 3, this guy has a continuous phase transition. Whose properties are controlled by the 6-5 minimal model. Okay? So it has, in particular, many operators, right? It has 1/2, 4 times 5, so 10 operators. Okay. And all of them are in one-to-one correspondence with terms that you can add to the Hamiltonian, essentially. Okay. And these are, I mean, just a parenthesis, this is an example in which the actual spectrum of operators of the CFT that describes the POTS model is non-diagonal. So the operators have different quantum numbers on the left and on the right. Okay? There is no law of nature that tells you that a given operator should have the same quantum number on the left and on the right. There are very strong constraints on what values of h minus h bar you can have, but and they can be realized, like in this case. Good. So this was just to give you just a view of the kind of models, of lattice models and critical behavior that can be described by these CFTs. And now what I want to do is to sketch how do we get to the CFTs from the things that we know about the representations of the Virasoro algebra. So essentially what I want to show is how these minimal models are associated with very special representations of the Virasoro algebra that have a null vector. Okay? So I have to explain what I mean by a null vector. And it's, but it will be precisely the existence of very special states in the representation. So remember that we constructed the representation of the Virasoro algebra by starting with the primary. So now I want to derive some of these things by analyzing the representations. With null vectors. So we saw that the states in the representation of weight H were obtained by acting on the lowest weight state with the Virasoro generators, and the basis we argued was this. Okay. Now, we already, in some sense, saw an example of the statement I'm going to make now. Is that it may happen? It can happen. For a special values of H, which is the dimension of the primary, that there is a descendant state, which is also primary. So this sounds crazy. So remember that I said that the descendants are operators that are, so remember that the primary, hopefully, I mean, you remember this, that these were states that are annihilated by the annihilation operator, so for positive ln, okay? Now what I'm saying is that for finely tuned values of H, you can construct a descendant state out of a primary. Let's call it chi. Which is also primary. So it means that chi is some linear combination. I don't know what the best notation for this is, but some linear combination of descendants, right? I think on a primary. So that's a particular descendant that we have to find. That on top of that, also that satisfies this. For positive n. Is it clear what the statement is, at least? So you can have states that are both descendants and primaries, OK? And the fact that such states exist only happens for very special values of the dimension of the primaries has far-reaching consequences, as we will see, that essentially will allow us to completely, I guess, okay, I want to solve the model, okay? So actually, I think some of the consequences you had to prove yesterday. So I don't know if you did or didn't, but something that follows quite immediately from these definitions, the fact that this guy is a descendant and is also a primary. The first statement is that chi itself has zero norm. So it's a state. Of zero norm. Did you guys prove that yesterday? Yes, okay. The other thing that's also important is that this descendant, by the way, this guy is called a null vector, okay? It's a null, sometimes it's called also degenerate. Chi is orthogonal all states in the representation. I think you also were asked to show that. And essentially, the thing to that follows immediately, that you can show this immediately, is just using the fact that L positive N, essentially annihilated, acting on the other side, will lead immediately to this conclusion. Okay. So this means that, yes. Yes, and in fact, for the minimal models, you have an infinite tower of null vectors. So one of the things that you have to do in order to establish all the null vectors, you have to look at all zeros, so all states in the representation that have zero norm. And that's something that we started looking at. Last time we looked at this matrix of dimension, right? So this matrix of inner product. We computed the determinant, right? And we saw, at least for low levels, that you can write it as a polynomial. And we saw this polynomial is of a certain degree, and we identified the zeros. So the null vectors are precisely at the location of the zeros of that determinant. Good. So what all this means is that Kai, since it is orthogonal to everyone, including it himself or herself, decouples. So the slogan is that Phi decouples from all states in the conformal family of A, because it's orthogonal. It doesn't talk to them at all. It's orthogonal to everyone. Okay. Is this clear? And now we will construct explicitly a simple case of this. So this null vector can appear at different levels. Okay. So essentially, the level at which it appears, it will depend on what is the energy or L0 eigenvalue of the creation operator that you have to act in order to get it. So we will construct now explicitly a level 2 null vector and study its properties. Okay. Now, something that will be important is that we know from the operator state correspondence that if there is a state that has this property, there is a corresponding operator. I don't know how to call it, maybe chi. So first of all, there is the operator state correspondence that any state in the CFT, including all descendant states, are created out of the vacuum from an operator chi, okay? And the statement that the state chi decouples from all states in the conformal family means that if you take the correlation function of chi z, which is the operator that creates this descendant, and you consider the correlation function with an arbitrary set of operators in the CFT. So these are and this is the null operator, so the operator that creates the null state. The fact that chi decouples from all states is the statement that this particular correlation function vanishes. This clear? And this will be very important, because what this essentially is telling us is that this particular object vanishes. Now we have to remember from previous lectures, and I think Anna did it yesterday very carefully. We found a way of writing the correlation function of a descendant, including that has a descendant operator in it, in terms of a differential operator acting on the corresponding correlator represent a descendant by the primary. Okay. So what this statement is telling us is that this implies that it exists a differential operator, a differential equation for the following correlation function, for the correlation function of the associated primary. Okay. So let me call this big thing capital X. This capital X is just a string of operators. They can be as many or as few as you like. It doesn't change the argument. The fact that this is true, which just follows from the fact that the corresponding state is orthogonal, null state is orthogonal to everyone else, implies that the correlation function is annihilated by some differential operator. And of course, phi is the primary operator that created the primary state from which we build this null vector. Okay. And this fact will play a huge role, because essentially what it's telling us is that we can at least extract local information about the correlation functions of primaries from solving explicit differential equations. Notice that this is amazing from the point of view of, you have been studying field theory before, and usually you start with the Lagrangian, and you do something or other. You do Feynman rules and so on. The thing that's very powerful about CFT is that you can essentially get to the correlation functions without ever talking about the Lagrangian. Okay? Even though it happens that sometimes the CFT has a Lagrangian description, like the Ising model happens to have a free fermion description. The fact of the matter is just consistency conditions allow you to completely determine the theory without having just knowing the operator content of the theory and some basic relations like unitarity, the fact that correlation functions should be single valued. And we'll see that this will allow us to completely solve for the correlate. Okay? The reason I mention this is that in recent years in higher dimensions, it has become very clear that this picture of that field theories are described by Lagrangian is a bit naive, because in four dimensions, say, there is an infinite class of field theories that we know do not have a Lagrangian description, but we still know something about them, like we know the operator content of them. And for example, one of the important open problems in that area is to precisely learn how we can calculate properties of the CFTs, even though we don't know the Lagrangian. And a prototype to attack that problem is precisely this. Here, we never talked about the Lagrangian, but just using clever consistency conditions, we're able to do it. Of course, in higher dimensions, it will be much harder because you don't have analyticity. So in two dimensions, analyticity plays a huge role. But at least, these two-dimensional examples are a huge inspiration for studying those problems. Okay. Not just here, there is no Feynman rules, there is nothing. We just solve directly the theory in one shot. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Like if you say that there is no Lagrangian description, is there some properties to the theory that doesn't allow, or we just don't know one?
Sorry?
Like if we say that there is no Lagrangian description to the theory, are there any properties of a theory that doesn't allow to make Lagrangian description?
No, so
we just don't know.
Yeah, so in this case, historically what happened is that originally it was not known whether minimal models had a Lagrangian description or not. It happened that 15 years later, people were able to construct in a very complicated construction a Lagrangian that described those theories. But the point was that you could solve the theories completely without referring, without ever talking about the Lagrangian. But in the thing I said before about four dimensions, there we know that there cannot be a Lagrangian in the conventional sense, because there is no small parameter anywhere. There is not really There is no real sense about talking about a path interval. You just have a set of observables, operators, and they form some algebra. And now you have to, in some way, construct the correlation function of those guys. But for the case of minimal models, originally they were solved by just consistency conditions without ever referring to Lagrangian. Many years later, it just happened to be the case that some smart people realized that by doing a very exotic construction, they could find microscopic Lagrangian description for that. But what I'm saying is that the logic of CFTs doesn't care, like, CFTs don't care about Lagrangian.
So what is Lagrangian for minimal models? Does it have a name?
Well, so for the simplest one, it's a free fermion CFT. I will mention that maybe more on Monday. For the other ones, I can give you the buzzwords that go with it, but it will not be helpful. It's a Gates WGW model, blah, blah, blah. But there is definitely a construction that you can do to that corresponds to that.
So a question?
Yes.
I mean, if you had a Lagrangian description, for example, I mean, you normally have, if you have, say, four-point correlator, if you want to look at four-point correlator,
yeah,
you can't fix everything from just come from all the values.
No, but here we have more than, we have this differential equation. Yeah, so conformal invariance, remember that what it did is was fix everything up to some function of the cross ratio. These differential equations exactly are the differential equations for that function.
So would you always get this differential equation?
Sorry?
Will you always get this differential
yes.
equation?
Well, for the minimal models, yes, that's the point. So the point will be that for minimal models, all operators in minimal models have the property that have null vectors in them. So there's a sequence of differential equations acting on all correlators that fixes them completely.
So my question was, if you don't have that, and you have a Lagrangian description, does it allow you to also fix that?
Well, so is the Lagrangian, so you typically, in some sense, the answer is no, because the Lagrangian will be some, in general, will be some interacting field theory. Another question is how do you compute the four-point function in an interacting field theory? Now, here, of course, the way to bypass it is that you go through this maybe more abstract logic and just solve it this way. But in general, all that you have access to is perturbation theory. It just happens also that in these Gates WGW models, you can solve them also using fancier techniques. But in general, if you have a Lagrangian, by definition, typically when you have a Lagrangian, you only have access to weak coupling. So then you can compute this function in perturbation theories. For example, people, and a lot of people in the building here do, like when you study n equals 4 super n mil, that's an example of a CFT, you can compute kind of this function as a function of the Gates coupling in perturbation theory. But it's not that you can write a beautiful equation that you know that answer for all coupling. Okay. So the main thing that to extract from here is that correlators, primary operators, obey differential equations. And we will derive them for simple cases, okay? So now, where are these null states, okay?
A question?
Yes.
In every Berman model, there is only one null state?
No, as I said, there can be many.
Okay.
In fact, there can be an infinite number of them.
Okay.
Like for the minimum models, precisely have this property.
But also at every level?
Not at every level.
Oh, no, I'm asking at every level. Is there always one, or can there
no, they be? There can be many. So let me write them down. So in order to really establish where the null descendant is, I think at least conceptually you would know how to do it, because a null vector is a correspond or null state corresponds to a state that has zero norm. Okay. So what you have to do is look at the CAC, the determinant of matrix of inner product, compute the determinant, and look at the zeros of that determinant. The eigenvectors associated to that with the zero eigenvalue are precisely the null vector. Okay? So you have to look at, first, the way this was done, which is a non-trivial work, is to be powerful enough to write down a formula for the determinant of the matrix of inner product at arbitrary level, write it as a polynomial of the dimensions and identify the zeros. And the second step that you have to do is once you have identified the zeros, find the eigenvectors associated to those zeros. Okay. And those are precisely the null vectors. And but we will construct it in a simple case of level 2. You can do it with our bare hands. Okay. So we get a null vector state at the level n or s. Remember that the level is essentially so L0, so from here, just means that this vector is at level m if L0 acting on this state is 8, which was the dimension of the corresponding primary plus n, right? Okay. And now by looking at this matrix of inner products and looking at the zeros, you find that you get a null vector at this level, at this very specific value of the dimensions of the primaries in the tower. Remember that we start here with some h, and we're going down by acting with Virasoro. And we're looking for the special states that are null, okay? But the location of this null state is completely determined by the quantum numbers of the associated primary, right? So these null vectors appear at these very special values of the conformal dimensions. It's 0 plus 1 quarter r alpha plus s alpha minus square, where r s equals 1, 2, and so on. H0, and these are functions of the central charge. So H0 is a specific function, which is C minus 1 over 24. And alpha plus minus is also a function of the central charge. 1 minus C plus minus square root of 5 minus C divided by 24. Okay. So if you start with a primary that has this property, that has this dimension, so exactly this dimension, you will the statement is that you will find a null vector at level n, which is the product of r times s, which parametrizes the dimension. Okay. Okay. So let's see this very explicitly in the case of level 2.
Gentlemen.
Yes.
A zero in my CAC determinant means that I get an eigenstate with zero norm. Right?
Yes.
Does this guarantee that this is also orthogonal to
yes.
the other states?
Yes. So I think I didn't say that the CAC determinant knows more about that. So the CAC determinant, if you have a null vector, so you have a null vector here, chi, at level, say, 2. Now you can act with this. On this null vector again with arbitrary number of Virasoro generators. Okay. The point is that all descendants of a null vector are also null vectors. So the CAC determinant also counts those in, but these are kind of not independent. These are null vectors that are derived from a parent null vector. The ones I'm fishing here are exactly the ones that are new null vectors. Below them, there's an infinite number of other null vectors that are just obtained from Virasoro.
Question?
Okay. Oh, yes.
Do I understand correctly if R and S are the labels of the primary,
uh-huh.
and the first null vector appears then at the level R times S, and there are no null vectors at lower levels?
Yes. So let's see. So now let's construct it at level 2. So it looks, you'll see that it's quite straightforward. So I think yesterday you were asked to do some of this. I don't know how much you did. Silence means that you did it or you didn't?
nothing that misleading. Okay, so now what I want to do is construct, so in particular, this should be the first kind of non-trivial example of a null vector appears at level 2. Okay. So one way of constructing it, you can either do it by what we did already last time, which was from the determinant of the 2x2 matrix that we computed, right? And look at the zeros. Another way to do is that relates more to this language, where I said that null vector is a vector that's also a primary, so it's annihilated by LNs with positive ends, is to write down the most general null vector at level 2. Okay, so what is the most general null vector at level 2? So I have a primary state here.
L minus 2.
Okay, so I can have either L minus 2.
Plus some strange constant.
Okay.
L minus 1 squared.
Yeah.
So this is the most general state that you can have at level 2. And in order to fish for a null vector, we want to kind of define the following two properties. We want L1 on chi to vanish, right? That's a statement that is also primary. And L2 chi to vanish, acting on chi vanish. Why don't I impose that Ln on chi vanishes for n bigger than 2? Do I need to impose this or not?
That moves automatically from Berzer algebra.
Jessica, can you explain why, maybe?
Well, because if we expect Ln on chi, when the greater than equal to 2, that actually greater than 2, then we can swap the Ln with L minus 2 or L minus 1 squared, and there'll be additional contributions from the commutator of universal algebra, which will, however, always contain Li, where I is greater than 0, which will act on H, so annihilation.
Okay. So did people more or less follow that? Okay. So the statement is that any Ln with n higher than 2 can be written in terms of linear combinations of commutators that involve L1 and L2. And therefore, since L1 and L2 already kill chi, Ln will automatically kill chi. Okay? Now the question, should I do this computation in the blackboard? This might be very painful for you and also for me. Let me maybe just sketch a little bit how you would do it. So let's look at this first case. It's completely straightforward. There's not really any trick, but I guess. Let me just sketch it a little bit. Even though I think you were asked to do this yesterday, but maybe you didn't get to it. Okay, so I want to calculate this and impose that this equals 0. So essentially what I need to do is to commute L1 through L minus 2, because I know that L1 acting on H vanishes, right? That's the definition that H is a primary. So what I need is that the commutator of L1 with L minus 2 is 3L minus 1. This just follows from Virasoro. And the other thing that we need is that the commutator, because I'm writing this, what I'm doing is I'm writing the product of these two operators as the commutator plus the other term, but the other term automatically vanishes, right? Because it kills the primary. And what I need now is L1, L minus 1 squared. And again, using the Virasoro algebra, you can very easily see that it's given by this. Okay. So this means that this guy is 3 plus 4h eta plus 2 eta equals 0. Now I can do the same exercise. So that was for L2. I can do it now for L, sorry, for L1, I can do it for L2. The logic is exactly the same. Now I just have to commute not L1, but L2 through this mess. And essentially, you get two equations, right? You get a similar equation that has to vanish. So you get a linear combination of things that involve the dimension and this parameter that tells you which particular linear combination will be null. So from these two equations, so from A, B, you get a solution. You get two solutions. First, you know that the linear combination is fixed to be -3/2 to h plus 1. OK? Well, so this one really just follows from this one, right? So if I put this to 0, and I solve for eta, you get precisely that, right? And from the second equation, you find that the values of h for at which this guy is null has two possible values, which is 1/16, 5 minus c, plus minus c minus 1, c minus 25. And if you remember, these values of h, these two values of h, are precisely the zeros of the level 2 determinant of inner product that we computed. Okay. This is what, in the previous class, we called h12 and h21. Okay. So at level 2, there are two possible values of the primary that guarantee that you'll get a descendant at level 2. Very good. Any questions about this? And in principle, now you could do in this language, you can either just look at the CAC determinant directly. This is perhaps a bit simpler. You could write down now at level 3, the most general level 3 vector, and impose that it is annihilated by the Virasoro generators, and you will completely fix the values of h for which that happens, and also the linear combinations. Good. So now what I want to do is to study the consequences of this null vector for correlation function, for the fusion, for the product of representation. Now what I want to do is essentially write down this differential operator associated to the null vectors that we just constructed, okay? And now I can borrow what we discussed and Anna derived carefully yesterday, that these correlation functions of, okay, maybe I'll change. Let me be consistent for one. So I guess from now on we'll call this W. It doesn't matter, of course. But, X. And again, X is just a string. For simplicity, let me take it off primary. So given that we know explicitly what the null vector is, we know the associated operator also from the operator state correspondent. We know that chi w is L minus 2 hat phi w minus 3 over 2 to h plus 1, the second derivative. Okay, so this arises from the
descend an operator at level 2. This is just some particular operator. And this guy is just L minus 1 squared. Remember that L minus 1 is represented on the operators as just a derivative. Okay. So this means that this guy the thing that you were asked to do is to write this as a differential operator, okay? By doing a contour deformation. Okay. So I don't think I have to do that. Let me do it in two steps, maybe, in case you forgot. But so this is some specific differential operator acting on the primary, where this is something that we've seen before. So let's write them down. What is L minus 2? In general, L minus n is the sum over the location. So here I have a whole bunch of operators. So from phi 1 to phi k. So here I sum over all operators that are in the string. N minus 1 hi divided by the location of the ith operator in the string minus the location of the primary minus 1 divided by wi minus w n minus 1. Derivative with respect to the position of the ith operator in the string. And this is this thing that was derived by doing a contour deformation of the integral representation of this guy and deforming it around the other pole and encircling all the operators that appear in the string. Yes?
And there's an m missing for the omega I minus omega.
Oh, very good. Excellent. So the differential equation that we get for this very specific level two null state is the sum from 1 to k second order differential equation. Okay. So just from the fact that any primary that has this particular value of h written there, h1, 2, or h21, has a level 2 descendant, we immediately obtain that the correlation functions of primaries in the theory have to be killed by this specific differential operator, okay? And now we will quickly see what kind of lessons we extract from here. One important lesson will be that in order for the correlation function to be annihilated by this, there have to be very special fusion rules, which mean multiplication of representations in the Virasoro algebra. So you can only get something non-zero if you multiply if you multiply two representations of the Virasoro algebra that are related in a very specific way that we will derive now. So let me bring that down. I'll try not to go over time too much.
Jeremy?
Yes?
I'm wondering about you have a second derivative of omega. Why isn't it that we do the same thing with the sum right there? Or L minus 1 squared.
There's no L minus
1.
Sorry? For the strip L minus 1 squared,
yeah.
Why don't we do the same?
But this is L minus 1 squared. So here I have two pieces. I have L minus 2, that's this stuff. And then I have this piece, L minus 1 squared, which is this.
Oh,
But you cannot pull us obtain it from the formula setting n equals 1, right?
Yeah.
Then you would have sum of.
Yes, okay, so here, okay, something I'm using. Okay, so that I'm using the fact that the sum wi, the sum of wwi acting on this is what? What does translational invariance of the correlation function say? That derivative of the correlator with respect to the positions of all operators has to vanish. So if I have here, okay, so maybe more explicitly, so I have phi at w and then phi 1 at w1 and so on equals 0. So I'm replacing the sum of wi's by the sum of, the sum of the derivatives of wi's by the derivative with respect to the other one. That's a consequence of translational invariance. But that's a good, I should have mentioned that. I think the next thing you were also asked to do in the tutorial, I don't know if you did it. This I will not really do in the blackboard, but I'll explain the logic at least. So now that we have this beautiful differential equation, we want to study what it implies for the correlator, okay? So the first thing that you can check, imagine that x has only one operator, okay? So this would be the correlation function. The two-point function of two primaries is killed by something. And something that you can check is that, well, first of all, we know what the two-point function of two primary operators looks like. We derive them from conformal word identities. And what you find is that, you get it's trivially satisfied. So if you use the fact, let me be complete. So if I use the fact that phi w1 is a constant. You get no information. It's really satisfied. Things become much more interesting if you look at the three-point function. So now, instead of taking x to be just one operator, I consider x to be the product of two operators. So phi 1 and phi 2. Okay. Now what I get is a differential operator killing, I guess I should put a parenthesis here. I get a differential operator killing the three-point function. But we know what the form of the three-point function is. It's fixed by conformal invariance. Okay, I'm not going to write this down. So you get some structure constant that essentially tells you it's a function of the dimensions, I guess. So I have h, h1, and h2. And then the denominator dependent is just fixed by the position. So I'm not going to write them down. Just one example. Remember that this is exactly what we derive from conformal word identities, the position dependent of the three-point function. And now, what we want to study is what does this differential equation tell us about the relation between, so at this level, h1 and h2 are completely arbitrary. H is fixed, right? H is the dimension of the descendant. So it's the dimension of the primary that gives you the null vector, so it's either h12 or h21. At this juncture, h1 and h2 are completely arbitrary, but what we, see, by just analyzing this differential equation, we find that a relation between the allowed values of h1 and h2. Okay, so let me use the following. So let's label the dimension. So So if you do this, you get some crappy looking quadratic equations that you have to solve. You have to introduce some good coordinates to see what's going on. So let me introduce them. So let me define h of alpha to be h0 plus 1 quarter alpha squared. h0 we already discussed before. It's just c minus 1 over 24. Okay. And let's associate to phi 1 a dimension corresponding to momentum alpha 1. The reason I call it momentum, because someone tell me why I call it, why this is a reasonable name for alpha 1. If you remember from the free scalar field, well, first of all, energy, okay, from the free scalar field, there were these nice operators, e to the I kx, right? And at some point, you were asked to calculate what the dimension of this guy was. And the dimension of this guy was exactly k squared. Maybe it's called k squared. So I'm going to use this language. So just to have some physical intuition of what's happening. So primaries are labeled by a certain momentum. You can label them by this momentum alpha. To the primary phi 1, we give it momentum phi 1. To primary 2, we give it momentum alpha 2. And then the differential equation constrains the values of alpha 1 and alpha 2 in the following way. Essentially induces a particular shift of the momentum. So if the primary, if the null vector that we use arises from the primary with h equals h to 1, we find the momentum of alpha 2 has to either be alpha 1 shifted by alpha plus, and I think I already wrote what alpha plus was, but I'll write it again perhaps. Probably write it somewhere. And if, so at level 2, there are two possible values of h that give rise to a null vector. For one value, you get that the momentum of the two other primaries have to be related by a shift of alpha plus. And if you consider the other null vector at level 2, you get that they're shifted by another number, which is alpha minus. And I think I wrote alpha plus and alpha minus, but I may have erased it. So luckily, no. Yeah, so this alpha plus and alpha minus, I mean this. Okay. Otherwise, the correlator is zero. Okay. So this is like a selection rule, a very strong selection rule. It's not that you can put any operator that you want and get a non-zero correlator. You only get a non-zero correlator if the quantum numbers that label the operator, in particular the dimension, have this very specific form. Okay. And that will be very constraining. I wonder if I should. Anna, as the boss, should I continue? I mean, or are people dead?
I don't know.
I'm half dead, but I can die more. The problem is that I don't really have a very good place to stop. Maybe it's a good place to stop because. Okay, so let me just anticipate what will happen next. What I want to say is that, first of all, what this implies at the level of operator language is that if you take an operator phi alpha and you tensor it with phi to 1, you can only get operators of this type. So this kind of selection rule here. But now, OK, so what we see here is something which is quite analogous to SU2 representation theory, that if you take something that has a spin. This 1-2 operator is very much like the spin 1/2 representation of SU2. So if you tensor spin 1/2 representation SU2 with another representation, you get two possible representations where the spin is shifted by plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. Okay. Unless we say something else, by keep iterating this relation, you will generate by fusion an infinite number of operators, right? With increasing values, increasing and decreasing values of alpha. Okay. So in the next lecture, what we will see, and that's where we will finally get to the minimal models, is that by tuning, we will see how this will arrive. So by choosing a specific value of the central chart, exactly those values that I wrote and probably erased here. I mean, remember that these were those values. We will see that this the fusion of representations truncates. And the corresponding CFT has a finite number of primaries. That's the first statement. And the second remarkable statement is that they close. Okay.
So what is the fusion?
Sorry?
What do you mean by fusion?
By fusion, I mean just tensoring. So when you have two representations, you can tensor them or fuse them. I mean, you should really think at this level. This is just representation theory, in some sense. I'm just multiplying representations of the Virasoro algebra. And I'm just saying that there are special representations that act as ladder operators in this particular way. And that for very special values of this X. Remember that in this discussion, C could be anything, right? C was anything. I didn't tell you what C was. But the second step of the logic will be that if we choose C to take these very specific values where P and Q are relatively prime, the type of representations that can appear in the tensor product will truncate. Okay? And then, essentially, we'll have a finite set of operators of primaries. All of them will have, the other important property that they will have is that all operators will have descendants below them. And then all correlation functions will be fixed by a set of differential equations. Okay. And we're going to write down the solution for the Ising model. Hopefully. So any questions?
Yes. I have a question on the charges in the two-dimensional CFT.
Charges?
Charges, yeah. What are the physical meanings, for example, in the setting of a condensed matter system of the infinite dimensional, or the infinite number of charges we have in our infinite dimensional algebra?
Well, notice that first of all, the real physical quantum number, so when we look at the Hilbert space of the theory, yeah, you have to diagonalize all commuting operators, right? So usually when you have a symmetry,
yeah,
you label states by what's called the Cartan-Sapp algebra, which are the maximal set, yeah, of commuting operators. But in this case, the only commuting operator is L0. Mm-hmm. So states are just labeled by L0.
But
so the other ones are, of course, very important in constraining the form of the correlation function, but it's not something that we measure. We measure the maximal set of commuting operators, which is the eigenvalues of L0, and these are the scaling dimensions or anomalous dimensions of the operator. It's like saying, what does J plus in SU2 angular momentum measure? Well, not really, because it doesn't commute with J3. It's a guy that just moves you along the representation, but doesn't have a direct quantum number.
So that means all the symmetries, all charges are conserved in that sense, so they commute with the Hamiltonian, but they don't commute with each other. And so we don't label states with them, but
I wouldn't quite say like that, because to have a symmetry that the charge that generated symmetry did not commute to the Hamiltonian. We saw an example, I mean, Lorentz transformation do not commute to the Hamiltonian. Right? P mu doesn't commute with M mu. But it's a symmetry of the S matrix, for example.
Yeah, okay.
But definitely, the for theories that have been a sort of symmetry, you label states by the maximal commuting algebra, which is L0. And the other ones are there, but they just, well, they tell you crucial information, like that there is a null vector, blah, 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 from which we get, from which we can solve the theory. But it's not that we're not diagonalizing L1 or L2 or L3, right? We cannot. Just like we cannot diagonalize simultaneously J3 and J plus in SU2. If you want, maybe let's discuss it if you want after the lecture. So if there are no more questions, I'll see you Monday. And Monday might be a long lecture, so come on.